we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here on this post-Christmas program right before the new year. Glad to have you with us on At the Core, American Family Radio. It's been a while since we've gathered live, but here we are. We are in John chapter 8 this week. John chapter 8, looking at verses 34 and 35. Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin, or a slave of sin, rather. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever." Verse 36, "Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." So verse 34, Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin." And so that's what sin does, and that's why Christ sets us free. But make no mistake, the ultimate slavery on this earth is when you're bound to sin and not free and not willing and able to live a free life in Christ. That's the ultimate slavery, the ultimate bondage in which Christ comes to free us of. And so that's John chapter 8, verses 34 through 36 there in John chapter 8. Well, a couple of things I want to mention before we move into some of the news for this segment. The 2026 tours are already open, and people are already registering. We are about a quarter of the way full for our Boston 2026 trip that's going to take place in late September. And we have folks already registering for Washington and Williamsburg, June and September. And so if you want to go on one of those, I would recommend going ahead and registering, because it never fails that people wait and then they miss. They miss the window because they wait too long. And so Boston's already filling up. Washington and Williamsburg registrations are already coming in for those trips. And so if you want to join us for any of those trips in 2026, we would love to have you. Just go over to wildmangroup.com, wildmangroup.com. Also, the Hannah's Heart Conference, which we've been teasing here on the program and on the network, is coming to you January 30th and 31st. That's Hannah's Heart, brought to you by the radio program that you hear on AFR each weekend, Hannah's Heart, as it's called. You can go over to AFR.net to view the event page, and the registration information is on the homepage at AFR.net, AFR.net. Well, looking into 2026, there's a lot we could talk about, but one of the most kind of forefront items on people's minds as we look at the last 12 months and we head into 2026 is the economy. And this was probably the number one issue going into the 2024 election, was the economy. And so it's noteworthy to kind of see where we've come from and where we're going. The interest rates, or the mortgage rates rather, have eased a little bit. They've come down roughly a point over the last 12 months. Most of that drop has come over the last 3 to 4 months. And so interest rates on a mortgage, on an average 30-year mortgage, are hovering around 6%. And it looks like that's going to continue to drop. House prices are continuing to ease, and not affordability, but availability on the housing inventory has risen drastically. And there's more homes on the market than there are people interested in buying them, which is a good thing for buyers to get those prices down. And so things are trending in the right direction. But as I told you multiple times, and Chris Woodward and I, we talk about this each Friday. We talk mostly economics when he's on with me. And But we said this is going to take a long time to fix. I mean, what Biden did was a disaster, and you can't fix that in like 3 months. This economy is a monster, and you can't just come in, sign a few executive orders, and then boom, everybody's better again. But we are seeing things trend in the right direction. Things have improved substantially. You're actually seeing real wage growth after inflation. You're still seeing wages actually grow now. Under Biden, wages were shrinking year after year due to inflation. Fuel, energy prices are down. Energy prices are down. Specifically, fuel is down substantially. We're looking at a gallon of gasoline well below $3 on average, but in some states down to $2.15, $2 a gallon. I've seen some pictures of gasoline under $2 a gallon in some states. But nonetheless, things are moving in the right direction. Charles Payne from Fox Business had a pretty good two-minute spiel on how we're trending and how he sees 2026 ending. Let's listen to clip one.
All America was left with was a T-shirt that says, "I'm in a runaway inflation and can't get out of it." It's a tall order for President Trump, but all the pieces are in place. And here's the thing. I just want to real quick, this is from Goldman Sachs, a top executive analyst there. And I just got to tell you, because you want sort of third party kind of thing, right? In 2026, we expect more constructive U.S. consumer backdrop, especially middle income, given a pickup in real income growth aided by job growth, tax cuts, fading tariff-related inflation. All of these things are in place. We are expecting a gangbuster year in 2026, a noticeable year where almost every American will feel it. And it will feel really good. And those who are naysayers who are doubting this, whether it's political or you just don't believe America can do it anymore, you're going to see it.
Charles, let me ask you this. Rental prices are down because we had 2 million illegal immigrants self-deport. You have gas prices down. Okay, that impacts every American in unimaginable ways. Right. Inflation is down. Interest rates are coming down. They come down much further. You're going to see sale of pre-existing homes go through the roof. And I would imagine right behind that is new home construction, right or wrong?
Absolutely right. Lennar, the second largest home builder in America, has already dropped their prices 27% since the pandemic. And they need the urgency. Everyone needs now in this industry, because everybody was pretty comfortable with the status quo, to get to work. Mortgage rates are coming down. When they get a five handle, when they're less than 6% for a mortgage, you're going to see a massive opportunities, because a lot of folks don't want to sell if they've got a 3% mortgage for a 6 or 7% mortgage. At five, that changes instantaneously. Tomorrow morning, speaking of inflation, we'll get the CPI number. A great analyst over at Bloomberg says that we've already seen peak inflation in appliances, apparel, sporting goods, personal goods, and things like that. So inflation going one way, wages going the other way, opportunity, it's going to be a spark. What we call in a financial community, animal spirits are going to be reawakened in a way that they really have been reawakened in this country.
Well, I don't think Charles Payne's exaggerating here. When you look at where we've been and where we're going with the Trump economy, things are only going to go up from here in multiple areas. The housing issue has been long overdue, but the housing since COVID has been largely overpriced. I mean, the prices on these houses is comical. I mean, my wife and I get kind of curious on occasion, and we'll either drive around or we'll get online and look at homes, and it's laughable. I mean, I drive by these houses and I'm like, no, I won't pay for that. And other people are saying the same thing, because these houses are sitting on the market for 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, and people aren't even interested in looking at them because the price is just so unpalatable. And so you've got to get past that. Well, how you get past that is you ease off on the prices. And look, there is no threat to equity here, okay? There is no substantial threat to people's home equity here, okay? Unless you bought or built during the COVID mania and you overpaid. That's the only people that are possibly at risk here. But this whole concern about home depreciation with the market coming down is just completely unfounded. All right, look, you might lose some equity compared to what you appraised it maybe a year ago, but it's not anything to get frantic about, okay? Everybody's homes are still going to be greatly appreciated. Homes are one of the top assets, physical assets you can own. Property and homes appreciate over time. History shows that. So they're a good investment. They're a good place to be. Home ownership is a net positive for anyone who participates in it. And so, but the home price is easing and values, valuations easing, you know, 5-10%. It's healthy. It's healthy. It's how you get the market moving again. And any you know, equity that you may lose through some of these home prices easing, you're going to pick up on lower interest rates. So it's really a win-win for everybody. And it's just unsustainable at the end of the day, regardless of what you think about it. It's just unsustainable, these home prices that have been going on for multiple years now. It's got to ease at some point. And mortgage rates are coming down. And the, you know, mortgage rates at 6% historically is pretty good. 5% is even better. Up at 8% wasn't really crazy, historically speaking. But when you look at the, this is what I tell everybody who talks about, well, in the 70s or in the 80s, you know, I had a 15% mortgage or a 20% mortgage, whatever. Yes, you did. I don't doubt you did. But the home valuations were not insane like they are now. I mean, people, you know, our grandparents were buying houses for $40,000. And this was a nice 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in a nice neighborhood. You know, so now that same house is appraising for $400,000. I mean, that's just insane. And so then you tack on a couple of extra interest points on the mortgage. That's a big deal. You're talking a $500 to $700 difference within a couple points. And so, not to mention homeowners insurance is through the roof across the country. And so it's just not, it's not apples to apples comparison. Inflation has truly done a lot of damage. And home value appreciations, they're good for people sitting in the house, but anybody wanting to buy, it's not very good. Not to mention when you're a homeowner and you're sitting on an appreciated asset, an appreciated home and a property, what are you going to do with that? I mean, if you're my point is, people who are trying to buy and sell and move, these overly inflated home prices aren't really good for anybody, all right? Because what happens is you say, well, I'm gonna cash out, I'm gonna get my equity, and I'm gonna go build somewhere or buy somewhere. And then you realize that by the time you pay overinflated prices to buy or build, you're back in the same place. And so there really hasn't been a lot of winners here with this overly valued housing market, unless you're gonna sell your overly valued home and take the cash and like go live in an RV or something until things go back to normal. But what is that? What does that look like? Things going back to normal. Things aren't going to ever be what they were. That's wishful thinking, you know, thinking things will go back to how they were before COVID. That's just not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. Because you can't pump $7 trillion in the economy through COVID stimulus and then say, oh yeah, let's go back to how things were. It's just not going to happen. Now, what you can do, and this is what President Trump is doing, and then I'll end up in my rant here. President Trump is helping people actually increase their wages. That is truly how you make a dent in the damage that Biden did to this economy, is you have consecutive years of real wage growth. That is actually how, maybe you don't go back to how things were before COVID, but you at least inch in that direction. I mean, this is the only way for the American worker and the American family to win, is to just have wages outpace inflation for consecutive years, for multiple years, back to back to back to back. That's how you do it, with inflation easing, wages growing, home prices normalizing, interest rates palatable. This is the kind of economy that people who want to work hard and make an honest living, they can do pretty well for themselves. And I think that's what we're going to see over the next 12 months in 2026. Not to mention retirement accounts are going to keep going up. We'll see you in a few minutes.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of the radio program today. Walker Wildman here on At the Core, American Family Radio. AFR.net is our website, AFR.net. You can listen live and go back and listen to past episodes there at AFR.net. Well, I want to welcome back a previous guest of the program, and that is Mark Wheat. Mark is General Counsel over at Advancing American Freedom, otherwise known as AAF, and he's with us now to talk about what is going on at the FDA. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the program.
Walker, very glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, glad to have you on, and this is a very important subject. And just to set this up for our audience, when President Trump was elected and, of course, transition period and sworn in, there were some concerns about how pro-life the FDA would be and the CDC and the HHS agency as a whole, and then underneath it you have these different sub-agencies. But we were pro-lifers, yourself and I, we were kind of curious, you know, how is this going to go on the life issue, because RFK Jr. hasn't been with us, just to put it bluntly, on the life issue from a political vantage point. And but now, here we are, we're almost 12 months into the administration, and there's hardly been any positive movement on the life issue over at these agencies under HHS. So bring us up to speed on where we are.
Well, the biggest concern that we've had is that, about 63% of abortions are now chemical abortions. The mother takes a pill called mifepristone and aborts her child chemically. And this is the biggest priority for pro-lifers, just to have a review of this drug, because we think it was approved illegally, and the safety protocols on it have been eliminated by the Obama administration and by the Biden administration. And then in the last year, the Ethics and Public Policy Center reviewed insurance records of over 860,000 times that this drug had been prescribed, and found that that women had an adverse event 11% of the time. Mm. So this is just astronomically higher, 22 times higher than what the FDA said. We thought that this would give some jet fuel to the review of the FDA of this dangerous drug, and they're just dragging their feet. It's been reported in the press that that the head of FDA, Dr. McCary, wants to push this off until after the next congressional elections. And we think in the meantime, women are in danger. And what is the problem? Why can't we get to the bottom of this?
Yeah, there's multiple things going on here. I mean, number one, the life of the mother and the child is very important. I mean, that is the driving issue here at stake, and we can't lose sight of that. On the peripheral, you've got the political implications that the pro-life community is one of the, if not the largest voting bloc issue-based in the conservative movement. I mean, there's no other voting bloc there's no other voting bloc at all that is as cohesive and large as the pro-life voting bloc. It's one of the largest political movements in the country and has been for decades. To push this off is just asking for trouble at the ballot box in 26. I mean, who's going to get motivated on the life issue if the FDA is dragging its feet on something very simple? I mean, this is a Biden-era expansion of mifepristone that should be easily reviewed and rescinded and then easily messaged on. I mean, this is not something hard to message on, that we want to protect mothers and babies. It's as simple as that. What do you think the White House thinks about this? Because I haven't heard much from the White House on this.
You know, it's hard to know. It would be good if we could have the White House spokesman or the president himself to weigh in directly, because it is it's something that this data has been sitting out there for years. And it took an organization, the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who we work with on many, many things, focusing on 860,000 events, and found that this drug is so much more dangerous than what the FDA had ever advised the public. Why we're trying to drag this on past the next elections, I think that that will just hurt Republicans. I think it will take the the voter turnout that we really need among pro-lifers to drive that down. And, you know, it doesn't look good for the Republicans' majority in the House as it is. Will this take down the Senate as well? I think it's just really bad politics. I think it's really bad policy. I think that there needs to be a lot of energy put into this to do a review. Mm-hmm. And even while we were expecting a review to be taking place, the FDA approved yet another generic version of mifepristone. Yep. So, you know, while we know it's dangerous, they're allowing another drug that we know has the same dangerous profile to be out there on the market. It's a really just a terrible situation.
Yeah, it is. Once again, we're talking to Mark Wheat, General Counsel with Advancing American Freedom. We're talking about the FDA and the life issue and what they're not doing that they should be. Mark, let me ask you this. There's the federal government and the FDA and the agencies under HHS, and then there's the states. And there's conservative pro-life leadership in dozens of states around the country. Can states do anything to address this mail order abortion, basically is what it is?
You know, they can, and that is a very hopeful sign. And, you know, when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, it threw the issue back to the states. And the states can protect lives within their borders, as they've always had the ability to regulate healthcare. And there's a very hopeful case that was decided in the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit is Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina. The state of West Virginia passed a pro-life law, and Danco, the company that manufactures mifepristone, sued and said, you cannot ban abortion because it would ban the use of our abortion drug, and that you are preempted from doing so by the FDA having approved our drug. And the Court of Appeals said that is a ridiculous claim, particularly in light of Supreme Court precedents that said that this is now a state issue. So states can restore protections that were there when mifepristone was approved and have them restored to help protect women from this drug. And, you know, this law was defended in court by Patrick Morrisey when he was Attorney General of West Virginia. He's now a pro-life governor of West Virginia. And so there are lots of states out there that are looking at West Virginia's success and thinking about how can they better protect women in their states.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the primary use case for this, per the FDA approval, is the ending of the life of the child. And so it's not as if this is, you know, off-label use, or it's a primary use over here and they're using it off-label over there. The pro-abortion side knows that the primary use in this case is the death of the child. And so with abortion being the primary use case for mifepristone in this instance, You're right. That should legally open the door for states to regulate it to protect the life of the child and the mother per the Dobbs ruling out of the Supreme Court. Mark, we got about 2 or 3 minutes left. Give our audience just a last word of encouragement on what they should be focused on and looking at as we go into the new year and we try to move the Trump administration further to the right on the life issue.
Well, we've waited for Roe v. Wade to be overturned for 50 years. And now that it has, now that it's in the ash heap of history, now it's a time that we can get our states motivated, activated, and moving in a pro-life direction. A lot of wonderful pro-life initiative can be bubbling up from the states and challenging federal law. And I think that this is the time that we do it. Let's not wring our hands and worry that nothing is coming out of Washington that's positive. Let's do it ourselves and make our states pro-life. And that is a very encouraging word for 2026.
Absolutely. Well, Mark Wheat, thanks so much for coming on the program. We appreciate your work over at Advancing American Freedom.
Thank you very much, sir. Very glad to be here and Happy New Year.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Mark Wheat, General Counsel, Advancing American Freedom, and their website is simply advancingamericanfreedom.com, advancingamericanfreedom.com. You can check out their work there. Appreciate Mark coming on. And to his point, you know, this is a no-brainer. There's no reason that this should be dragging on. We're about to head into month 12 of the Trump administration in January. And it just shouldn't be this difficult. I mean, there's so many other victories under Trump's belt that why not add this to the list? And this is a far left Democrat wish list item that Biden approved, and that is the expansion of the abortion pill. And President Trump ran on highlighting Vice President Harris's pro-abortion, radical pro-abortion viewpoints and how bad it is for our country and how radical it is, and that helped him win the election. And so it's not as if this is a complicated issue or one of political sensitivity. That's just not the case. This is a slam dunk, no-brainer, easy political move to make. And that is to begin the process and expedite the process of reviewing and rescinding the Biden-era abortion pill expansion. And that's just the first step. I mean, if we really want to be honest here, we need to rescind the whole thing altogether. We don't need mifepristone on the market for the use case of abortion at all. I mean, there's no case in which the Food and Drug Administration should be authorizing a pill that sole purpose is to kill the life of the child. I mean, well, let's just take a step back and look at it from that vantage point. And so what we're asking the Trump administration to do today is to rescind the Biden-era expansion, okay? I mean, this is not a heavy lift here. Rescind the Biden-era expansion, which made this abortion pill available on demand in the mail via the U.S. Postal Service. Anybody in America can order this abortion pill now and kill their child with no questions asked, no doctor supervision, no regulation, no waiting period, nothing. And so that's what's happening, and we just simply want that rescinded. And then, of course, the ultimate goal is to rescind mifepristone altogether because there's no medical use case that's appropriate for killing the life of the child. There's no case in which that's a good thing that we should do. And this is the whole irony of abortion, is the whole thing's messed up. The whole situation from the ground up is evil and it's wicked and it ought not be tolerated. And so we're just trying to chip away at it. We're trying to regulate it and regulate it back into non-existence. That's the only way to go about this. And it starts with reviewing and rescinding the Biden-era abortion expansion that happened under President Biden. And so the FDA's got to get its act together. This is what President Trump campaigned on, by the way. These are the coalitions that he brought together for the 2024 election. And so if the White House is serious about keeping their promises, then they need to get their act together on this. I mean, you can't keep ignoring this. You can't keep kicking the can down the road, hoping that the economy is going to save the day for the voting base. That's just not going to happen, all right? It's a slow-moving target, a slow-moving process. And the life issue, a lot of voters care about this. A lot of voters care about this. And as I've said, most importantly, it's the right thing to do. And so we'll continue to track that and see where that goes. But it's not looking good for the FDA head, Marty McCary, when he's kicking this can down the road. So I think the White House is going to have to get involved. I think the president's going to have to get involved and tell McCary, look, get on board or get out. Get on board or get out, because we're not fostering the Biden policies of abortion on demand anymore. We're just not doing it. That's not why I got elected. And I know that what I'm saying sounds simple, but apparently in D.C. it's not so simple. So we'll continue to track it. And President Trump, you know, he takes pride in undoing all that Biden did. And so why leave this on the table? Why leave this in place over at the FDA? And by the way, the FDA has got a lot of credibility that they need to regain with the American public after they completely fumbled the whole COVID pandemic and signed off on these experimental shots that don't work. So we'll be back in a few minutes, and we got one segment left.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here on this late December edition as we head into the new year. I hope each of you had a very Merry Christmas, and I hope you have a Happy New Year. As after today's live program, we won't see you guys until the new year. And so next guest I want to move to is Utah State Representative Nicolene Peck. And Nicolene is representing District 28 currently in the Utah House of Representatives, and she's with us now. Representative Peck, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Walker. I'm happy to be here.
Well, glad to have you on, and we have on different representatives and state senators around the country to talk about what they're doing to protect America's families. And on that note, or before we jump to that note, rather, tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up in the House of Representatives there.
Yeah, well, I actually ended up in the House of Representatives because I have spent so many years of my life protecting families. So I'm a mother of four, I'm a grandmother, but I also did therapeutic treatment care for troubled teens for a lot of years who were abused and stuff. And then people started to ask me to teach parenting and to write books and to speak places. And then this organization called the Worldwide Organization for Women asked me to speak at the United Nations. And that was about 14 years ago. And then they asked me if I would head their organization. So I have been consulting, doing family advocacy work around the world with the World Congress of Families, trying to stop the UN from all of its shenanigans, that kind of stuff for a long time. And the people in my area knew that. And so when a spot came open, they asked if I would run for that. And so I'm bringing that expertise into all the work that I do. And I've got a lot of bills about families coming up this year.
Well, before we jump into the bills you're talking about, tell us about the fact that you guys have passed, and it's on the books now, age verification for minors on websites. Tell a little bit about that.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate about that, right? The people came in, the free speech, like, hey, what about, you know, what about free speech? And the online companies were pushing hard against it. But we did get that passed, and it has been great. So we don't have Pornhub, for instance, pulled out in our state. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no porn and there's no, inappropriate materials online that children can access. There absolutely is. In fact, that's some of the stuff that I'm trying to really hit at the root of, especially because it's coming into our schools a lot more than people want to admit. Our state, at first, when I started addressing this back in 2018, there was a person on the Senate floor who said, Nicolene Peck's a liar. She was going to call me out and said it wasn't there. And now everybody has to admit it is there. And now they're like, well, so what that it's there, right? Some people are saying, so what? That's usually the left who's saying, so what that it's there. And everybody else is going, nope, this is it. We're finally going to get this done. So we've been trying to chip away at this for a long time, and we're hoping to make some good strides this year.
So, Utah, I'm assuming your legislative body meets annually. Is that correct?
Yep. We have 7 weeks, 45 days of session.
Wow. Okay. So that you got to get stuff done, right? No time to waste. Tell us what you're working on for this upcoming session.
Yeah. Well, first off, we're working on a CSAM bill. So CSAM is child sexual abuse materials. And this particular bill, so we already have some laws on the books related to child sex dolls, which are just a gross thing. If you even know what those are, that people can even buy a doll to do this obscenity with. But we have some laws on the books about that, but this law would make it so that we create more of an opportunity for people to sue if there is a problem with their likeness being on one of these child sex dolls, or if their likeness is distributed in obscene material as far as child sexual abuse materials go. And we'll make it so that they can collect, monetary damages and punitive damages. And it makes it so that if the person has their likeness on it, they can sue. But also anybody in the state can say, you know what, we're suing. Like, this is not okay. This shouldn't be happening here. So appropriate, protections need to be put in place on this type of stuff. And obviously it's illegal anyway to do child sexual abuse material. I really anticipate that this will be something that we can get bipartisan support on, because, who wants child sexual abuse material out there? But another bill that I'm working on that relates to digital obscenities is a bill about school materials. And this is about digital materials as well as physical materials. So, like I said, since 2018, I've known, and this was even before the book debate, the national book debate that's been going on for a long time now. Even before that, me and a friend from Colorado started exposing this international scandal on EBSCO and Gale databases and these things in the schools. And then the attention turned toward the books, because those were tangible things that they could point to on the library shelf and prove. And we didn't fully get these databases under control. Well, every child has a tablet in their classroom. And when they get on these tablets and they are asked to do research in these databases that are curated, they're supposedly clean and safe. They are absolutely not. They're selling to the children. They can type in a word like daddy, and it will take them to the Gale Encyclopedia of Sex and Gender. And what it used to do, I haven't looked at it recently, but it would say a daddy is basically a guy. There's heterosexual daddies and homosexual daddies, and daddies are adult males who have sex with children, and they normalize it. And then they even had live links to where they could go to hook up with men, to do these hookups. And anyway, and so we exposed that. We've done audits on that in our state. And I'm really excited about this bill, because this bill is going to incorporate all of the recommendations from the audits. And one really key audit, really key recommendation in the audit was that we proactively select everything that's shown to children. This should not be a novel idea, right?
Right.
like this like should betting. Be like a no-brainer. Yeah. This should be a no-brainer idea, but we absolutely, are not having that happen across the nation. What is happening is we're playing cat and mouse, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what's there? Let's try and find it. What's there? Let's try and find it. And as long as the people distributing this stuff can keep us playing cat and mouse,
yep,
then it will be a perpetual problem forever.
Yeah, forever. To your point, the example is like parents, responsible parents don't like like hand their kids something and then like after the fact go, oh, let me look at that. Like if you do that, that's not good parenting. And we've probably all done that for a time or two. But we need to vet the stuff before it makes it to the children's hands. And so whether we're talking, you know, what they're eating or what they're consuming with books or online, to your point, proactive is the way to go. I mean, this reactive damage control mentality is just not wise in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, with AI now, you can put in the text of any book or any website or anything and say, does it violate this piece of code? Does it violate this? You know, and so this bill is going to really take those proactive steps and just amp them up. And I'm really excited that it's going to make it so that they can't sell to children too, because they've got like, you can go to like Adam and Eve's sex store and they're selling sex toys to children, let alone, you know, selling skateboards or whatever else and subscriptions. But I mean, just really graphic things. And school shouldn't be a place where our children are a market for someone. Like, why are we paying money to turn our children into somebody else's revenue?
Yeah.
That's called exploitation. There's a word for that. And so both of those bills, the CSAM bill, it really dials back this exploitation that is obvious, right? People go, oh, child sexual abuse. Yep, that's exploitive. But they don't recognize that when we're selling our children at school, we're also being exploitive. So those two are some of my main bills for exploitation. I have another bill, actually, that I'm really excited about, which will make it so that we can really do a better job at dialing back human trafficking as well, which also has a lot to do with child exploitation. So I don't know if you've ever noticed in airports, but on the back of the restrooms, at least in the women's restroom, Walker, I don't know about the men's, but there's a number. It's like this big, long number, like call this number.
Yes.
Nobody remembers the number. So we're going to make a little 3-digit code that anywhere people can call. And so it's, you know, it'll be like a 997 or something like that, where people can remember the number and they can actually get the help that they need. So we're excited about that. So I really care about protecting, you know, children. That's a big, big deal for me.
I want to get your opinion. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. I want to get your opinion on the AI moratorium idea, because the Trump administration, President Trump himself and others have been saying, oh, we need a moratorium on AI regulations. We don't need to strangle the AI sector. It needs to blossom. It needs to, you know, be able to do what it has to do so we can be AI dominant, whatever. But I understand kind of the business side of that, of not wanting all 50 states to have different AI regulations. But at the end of the day, AI can be used for extreme harm. It can be used for extreme harm here. And I think an AI moratorium on AI regulations is just overall a bad idea. I think states need to look over the shoulder of these AI companies, but I want your thoughts.
Yeah, actually, I agree with you. Our state really went to bat when some of this don't regulate AI stuff was going to be in the big, beautiful bill. Our state sent a delegation of representatives and senators out there to say, no, 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 because we've got a rep in our body that even used to work for those big tech companies. And he's like, no, don't do this. Like, we need to be able to regulate here. And the exploitation is real. I mean, children are killing themselves, right?
Yeah.
So I get it. I get the AI race. I get us wanting to come out ahead so that we're not exploited by other countries with AI. I get that. Like, yeah. I understand that. But at the same time, I think there has to be a way to say, you know, for children, you know, this has to be a regulation. I mean, in our state, we're this year going to be dialing back the tablets in the classrooms and stuff like that. We're saying, nope, we don't need to start them that early. We don't need to do that. We're starting to pull it back around here because we've seen the writing's on the wall. We pulled cell phones out of the classroom. We're pulling it back. So why wouldn't we protect children otherwise? And I think we can expect, I mean, on my parenting website, there's a Nicolene bot. Okay. We've trained it. It's not perfect. It still messes up all the time, but You can train AIs, and I think we have to hold the people who are training the AIs accountable in some way. And
Yes.
so I think we have to say there's certain things that are just off the table. Now, I don't believe in being China and saying you can't give information, but I think when you're teaching somebody how to kill themselves, and especially when that person's a minor, I think we've crossed over a very serious ethical line. And I think that the person who trained that AI bot needs to be held accountable. And at least that's my opinion. And I think states
Yeah.
need to be able to say that.
Yeah, and it's a similar, basically, you take how we hold humans accountable and you kind of copy and paste it to a degree. I know it's not apples to apples, but the same moral standards that we have that are enshrined in our law should be applied over in the tech side and the AI side as well. Representative Peck, thanks so much for coming on the program. We appreciate your work, and we'll talk again, hopefully, this after this session once some of your bills pass.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks so much. That's Utah State Representative Nicolene Peck serving District 28, talking about all that she's doing to protect children in the state of Utah and some of the pieces of legislation that she's talking about there and working on for this upcoming session starting in January. You know, on the AI front, for the last few minutes we have left, the whole talk about China and the U.S. being in an AI race, if we're being honest, there's nobody else in the race. It's the U.S., okay? Anybody who truly understands the economy, truly understands the energy infrastructure and the data center infrastructure understands that America is the only game in town. And that's not an exaggeration. I'm not being overly boastful. I'm just telling you to act as if communist China is like our chief competitor on the AI front is just pure fairy tale land. I mean, China's got, don't get me wrong, China's got some areas in which they've advanced that is somewhat catching up with us, but AI is not it. Okay, AI is not it. They might be building more Navy ships than we are. They might be pumping out more, Air Force jets than we are, but they're not competing with us on AI. That is literally a completely made up message that is brought to you by big tech and the AI companies because they don't want to answer any questions. All right, so what do? You create the boogeyman that is China, and nobody likes China. Nobody wants China to beat us in anything, right? And so, but China is not is not with us on AI. They're not even close, okay? And we've got the energy infrastructure. We've got the nuclear technology to power the data centers. China does have some of the rare earth minerals. Taiwan's got the chips. But the American technology market is the only game in town. I mean, we are the leader in the world on multiple fronts. And so that's not a genuine concern. We'll see you next time.